friends. You may remember, those of you who were here last week, that last week we came to a turning point in our whole course of lectures on aspects of Buddhist psychology. Up to last week, we had been addressing, we may say, the conscious mind, whether in the lecture on the analytical psychology of the Abhidharma, or the lecture on the depth psychology of the Yogacara, and so on. In all these cases, we were addressing the conscious mind and using, therefore, what we may describe as the language of concepts, the language of abstract ideas, of abstract thought. It was only last week that we started addressing, started trying to speak to, started trying to penetrate to, if possible, the unconscious mind. And therefore, we started using the language of images, the language of myth, of legend, of poetry, and so on. And we started also exploring last week what we may describe as the archetypal world. And we studied some of the archetypal symbols which occur in the biography, the so-called legendary life of the Buddha. Now today we are continuing that exploration. But we are continuing it, we may say, within a rather different context. Last week we studied the archetypes, the archetypal symbols in the context of the so-called legendary life of the Buddha. Today we are studying them within a quite different context. We are studying them within the context of death. This evening, our subject, as you've heard, is the psycho-spiritual symbols of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Now, death, we may say, is not a very popular subject. I was going to say that people don't exactly come flocking to a lecture on death, but it seems that that is just what they do. I must admit that I have sometimes been rather surprised. I remember a couple of years ago when I gave a series of fortnightly lectures at Kensington for a whole year on various aspects of Buddhism. The biggest attendance was when we had a lecture on Buddhism and the problem of death. Then they really did turn up, I won't say in their hundreds, but certainly the room was packed. I think so far as Kensington was concerned, that particular occasion, it was probably because we had in the neighbourhood rather a large number of spiritualists. It might also have been because quite a number of people do find death a bit of a problem. But it is, after all, a problem which we all have to face sooner or later. We have sometimes lectures on meditation. Well, sometimes people are not all that interested in meditation. You don't have to meditate. They may not be all that interested in Buddhist philosophy. You don't have to study that. And even in Buddhist psychology, even in aspects of Buddhist psychology, they may not be particularly interested in that subject either. But you can hardly help being interested in death. A human being, in fact, can hardly help being interested in death. At least so much one would have thought. But we do find, unfortunately, that here in the West, very often, people are rather reluctant to face up to the fact of death. and in some circles it seems to be considered even rather indecent to refer too openly or too bluntly to this fact of death. It is perhaps significant that in this country, in the English language, we have quite a large number of euphemisms for death. Instead of saying, for instance, that someone has just died, bluntly and crudely like that, we tend to say, well, he's passed away, or even passed on, or again even passed over. Or we sometimes say that she is no more. We put it as indirectly as that. And some people I have even heard say, he has gone to his heavenly home. Some put it in that way too. Others merely say gone away or been called away. But we have all these various euphemisms for this plain and simple fact of death. It's as though people don't like to pronounce this word, don't like to say that old so-and-so is just dead. And all this reluctance to face up to recognize the fact of death, we may say, is due basically simply to fear. We just don't want really to die. So very often we pretend, or we try to pretend, that we won't die. We just ignore that fact. We just shut it out of our minds. We force it into the background of our consciousness, where it lurks all the time, ever ready to spring out, as it were, but always kept in the background, in the shadows, not recognized, much less still accepted. But in the East, I would say, broadly speaking, as compared with the West, we do not find this state of affairs. In the East, I would say, having lived there for some 20 years, I would say that death was accepted much more easily, much more readily, than it is in this country, in the West generally. One might even go so far as to say that sometimes, or even very often, in the East, people look forward to death. Quite ordinary people, not saints and sages and yogis and mahatmas, but quite ordinary people look forward to death. They even look forward to old age. In Buddhist countries, we may say, people look forward to old age very often with positive enjoyment, because they think their children and their grandchildren will be grown up. They won't have very much to do, no household affairs to look after. They just grow old gracefully, accumulate merit, and look forward to dying. In Chinese Buddhist circles, for instance, they order their coffins well in advance, have beautifully carved and lacquered ones, and keep it in state, as it were, in the sitting room. And when a friend comes to tea, or just to see them, they take him into the sitting room and say, look, my coffin, magnificent teak, isn't it lovely? This is what I'm going to be buried in. And they're quite happy and quite pleased about it all. So this tends to be the Eastern attitude. I recollect in this connection there's a poem by that great Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, in the course of which he says, I know I shall love death because I have loved life. And this is indeed the Eastern attitude. This is a typical expression of the Eastern attitude, to love death because you have loved life. You see, you recognize, you accept that life and death are two aspects of the same thing, two sides of the same coin. So that if one loves one, one can hardly avoid, one can hardly help loving the other also. Now in Buddhism, which historically speaking is an Eastern religion, an Eastern spiritual tradition, in Buddhism, very great attention indeed is paid to this question of death. And Buddhists of whatsoever school are exhorted all the time to be mindful of the inevitability of death, to remember all the time, in the midst of life, in the midst of youth, in the midst of health, in the midst of pleasure, to be mindful, to recollect that one day one will be no more. One day one will come face to face with this fact. What appears to us almost a terrible reality of death. Those of you who have attended the meditation classes, those of you who have heard perhaps some of the talks which I've given on the subject of meditation, will recollect that recollection of death, being constantly mindful of one's inevitable end, end at least of the physical body, is one form of one of the five basic methods of meditation, designed to cure us of the disease, the sickness of craving. Now, in Buddhism generally, in Buddhist tradition, Buddhist teaching, there are many teachings and traditions on this subject of death. If you look through Buddhist literature, you'll find that there's quite a big literature simply on this subject of death. One might even say quite a vast literature in various languages, canonical and non-canonical. But one may say also that there is one source, one literary source for this subject of death in Buddhism, which stands out above all others. One source which, as it were, synthesizes the whole of the Buddhist teaching on the subject of death. Not only synthesizes, but adds, we may say, unique, esoteric elements of the highest value. And this source, this text, is the one with which we're concerned today, that is to say, the Tibetan Book of the Dead.